This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Ben Bernanke wants to meet the press on a regular basis.
It's a way for the Fed to let us in on what it's doing.
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for checking out the podcast from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's March 25th. Coming up, is there a safer way to build a nuclear power plant? The economy of demographics. And the retired folk aren't so fast to put away those wool sweaters. All ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
The Federal Reserve has announced that four times a year, Chairman Ben Bernanke will do something his predecessors haven't been willing to do, take questions from reporters. Let's go to our reporter now in Washington, David Gura, for the details. Hi, David.
Morning, Jeremy.
So why has the Fed decided to do this?
Well, there's been a lot of concern from some Americans and from some members of Congress about why the Federal Reserve did what it did during the financial crisis.
Right.
And people want to know why it's done what it's done since then. Now, Ben Bernanke's talked to reporters before, he's done TV interviews, and he's a former Princeton professor. So the goal here is for him to use those talents to make more people more aware of how federal monetary policy works and to help them understand how the Fed makes decisions.
But David, one of the big things about the Fed is it's supposed to be removed from daily political back and forth in Washington. Don't you think this is just going to add more political pressures to the Fed's decisions?
Well, look, this is risky. Chairman Bernanke knows that when he speaks, everybody listens, not just in the U.S., but around the world. He's probably going to focus on the past as much as he can. He'll still steer clear of what the Fed could do or what it might do. But Don Kettle, the dean of the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, says that's probably easier said than done.
Every good reporter is going to be trying very hard to try to wheedle out of Bernanke some sign about what it is that's likely to happen. And as has always been the case, a sneeze or a sniffle from the Fed can be enough to move the markets.
Now, the first news conference is scheduled for April 27th. I'll be there, Jeremy, with my notebook and microphone. I might even bring some Kleenex.
Stay dry. Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy and David, the Fed came out with a survey this week about how much families bring in here in the U.S. and about how Americans make less and own less than they did before the financial crisis. So what does that survey really tell us? Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch, and she's with us from New York, as she is every Friday. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So break this survey down for us.
Well, everybody lost in this survey, but those at the bottom lost less when it comes to income, while those at the top saw more dramatic losses in their income levels. So not spread evenly. The rich did worse.
The more money you have, the more money you lost. All right. Everyone spends money, Jill. Does this mean people are spending money differently?
Well, now you might think that we would spend differently because of those results, but people at the bottom definitely pulled back more. They were replenishing their savings and paying down debt. But here's the big surprise. The wealthy kicked up their spending, especially on those nice luxury items. So they did not let their income levels deter them.
So bottom line, Jill, what do these numbers say about the economic recovery going forward?
Well, you know, we always hear this statistic that consumers make up 70% of the economy. That's actually important because if we don't see more people spending robustly, we continue to have this slow growth economy. And don't forget, a slow growth economy means fewer jobs created at a quick enough pace. That's what we're stuck with right now.
All right. Jill Schlesinger at CBS Money Watch in New York. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Well, while pocketbooks among some people are getting smaller, the number of people in certain demographics is getting bigger. The Hispanic population in the U.S. went from about 35 million in the year 2000 up to 50 million in 2010. That's a 43% rise. Latinos now make up 16% of the U.S. population. Let's get into the numbers with our regular Friday guest, Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial. He's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, as an economist looking at these numbers, what do you see?
Well, you know, because I'm an economist, it's always the first thing I think about when I look at a story like this. What's the economic motivation driving it? And, you know, what's interesting is the two big trends that pop out from the census numbers, the increase in the Hispanic population, and also the movement of the population toward the South and the West,
right,
were driven by the boom in housing in the last decade.
And the housing bubble did bust, as we all know so well. Does that mean that these numbers have sort of gone out of date?
Well, yeah, I suspect what it means is that these trends probably crested 3 years ago. We know from census estimates that particularly the male Hispanic population has fallen in the last couple of years because it's so hard to find jobs here.
Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial, thanks for your analysis this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you.
To the world of bailed out companies now, the lender CIT, which finances small and medium-sized firms, may be making a comeback. Remember that it filed for bankruptcy back in 2009, even after it got government money. And this week, CIT raised a couple billion dollars from bond investors. Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains.
Don't call it a happy ending yet, but maybe it's a happy middle. This week, CIT sold bonds for the first time since its bankruptcy. They were junk bonds, but investors seem to believe CIT will improve its credit ratings and its profits. So says Tom Ferguson, a bond analyst with KDP Research.
That CIT can go to the market and relatively easily raise $2 billion. It says something about the optimism investors hold in terms of CIT's ability to perform.
Ferguson gives credit to CIT's new chief executive, John Thain, who once led the New York Stock Exchange and Merrill Lynch. CIT's comeback could be good news for small and medium-sized companies that have found it hard to borrow since the financial crisis.
I think the past 3 or 4 years have been so tough on so many banks that it's created a bit of a vacuum that CIT can and should fill.
CIT's new bonds will lower the company's debt burden, which means more money for it to lend to those cash-strapped companies. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
The economy in the last quarter of 2010 grew at an annual rate of just above 3%. The Commerce Department said today the nation's revised gross domestic product, or GDP, was about what analysts had expected.
But rising oil prices, i.e. gas prices, are expected to limit growth this year for the GDP. Oil, by the way, is slightly lower today at just under $105 a barrel. The price of gas is also doing a number on how people feel about the economy. We got word from Thomson Reuters and the University of Michigan that consumer sentiment fell to its lowest level in more than a year. Looking for more numbers? They're at our website in the numbers section at marketplace.org.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Carbonite Pro automatically backs up computer files to a secure location with anytime, anywhere access from any computer or smartphone. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, March 25th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. You can follow me on Twitter at Radio Chio.
I'm Jeremy Hobson on Twitter as well, at Jeremy Hobson. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. Because of higher radiation levels coming from the Fukushima plant in Japan, the government there is asking even more residents who live near the plant to leave.
Of course, we look at Japan's nuclear crisis as a cautionary tale for nuclear plants in our nation. Peter Coy is a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, and in the new issue, he says there is newer, safer nuclear technology on the horizon here and around the world. But the focus on Fukushima and other plants that are decades old could overshadow that. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
What is wrong with today's reactors?
Today's reactors are built on a standard that was developed in the 1950s. And the problem is that you can't just, you know, let the plant go off on its own and shut down by itself. The pumps go out, suddenly you have a huge problem circulating the water that's needed to cool down that uranium. The boiling water reactor that was used in all of the reactors in Fukushima is used in roughly a third of the plants in the U.S.
Yeah, but the dangers at our plants here are different than the ones in Japan, right?
Basically, you never know what could go wrong, and we constantly get blindsided by disasters we didn't expect to happen. I spoke with a spokesman from Tokyo Electric Power about this, and I said, you know, were you prepared for a worst-case scenario? He said, yes. But I said, well, what about this one then? He said, well, I guess we weren't prepared for a worst case scenario. And the thought is, how can you prepare for everything? Now, the new plants that are being built now, they are substantially safer. They're about 100 times as safe in terms of the risk of a core failure as the current fleet of plants.
Can these be 100% safe, though?
These nuclear power plants are not 100% safe. Anytime you're splitting atoms, you're taking some kind of risk. It's really going to be a matter of society weighing the risks.
Peter Coy, economics correspondent for Bloomberg Businessweek, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Toyota, Honda, and Nissan are just some of the companies that have had to suspend production because of the disaster in Japan. And the industry research firm IHS Automotive now says auto companies here in the U.S. will really start feeling parts shortages next month. Let's continue our coverage of how Japan's disaster is affecting the economy with Michelle Krebs, senior analyst at Edmunds.com. She's with us now from Detroit. Good morning.
Good morning.
Give us a sense of what's actually going on where you are.
At the moment, there's no big changes. We aren't seeing massive shutdowns of plants, but we are seeing automakers scramble to find where they might be vulnerable, what part might be made in Japan that could slow or shut down their production here. For instance, Ford telling its dealers not to order a certain color because the pigment comes from Japan. But I think in the next month, we may start seeing some plant shutdowns because of parts shortages.
And how difficult, Michelle, is it for companies to simply adjust the supply chain a bit and get their parts from other places?
Well, it's very difficult because there are a couple things at play. First of all, the supply chain these days is global, whereas, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was not. The other thing that has changed is most manufacturers operate on a just-in-time delivery system. So they don't have warehouses full of parts. They only build that number of parts for the vehicles and have them delivered to the factory. So that means a glitch could shut down the assembly line.
Michelle Krebs, senior analyst at Edmunds.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Almost a year after the biggest oil spill in U.S. history, and the British oil giant BP is in trouble again. A $15 billion deal for access to key oil fields in Russia is hanging by a thread. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
Just after last year's disaster, BP signed a $15 billion deal to drill for oil and gas in the Arctic, its partner, an oil company largely owned by the Russian government. But BP already had some Russian partners. They weren't part of the deal. They felt shut out and took legal action to stop it. They've just won their case. Neil McGregor is an oil analyst with stockbrokers Redmayne Bentley. He says BP has just suffered another big hit to its reputation when this Arctic venture was supposed to improve its image.
This deal showed that BP was hurt by the Gulf of Mexico, but not yet crippled, and could still be a large player in large deals going forward in new frontiers.
If the Arctic deal does fall through, BP may have to pay the state-owned oil company a fortune in compensation. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Staying in Russia now, 1,500 top beef cows recently arrived there from Montana, a half dozen cowboys, too. It's a unique joint venture between two Russian businessmen and an American rancher. Reporter Peter Van Dyke went to see how the project is going.
Daryl Stevenson has spent most of the past 2 months in the southern Russian region of Voronezh working to create a cattle ranch out of nothing. It's nowhere near finished, which makes the Russian winter harder to deal with.
This storm today is not good at all. You can see for yourself, we can't see, but maybe 200 meters out here, and the wind is blowing, and these calves need some protection.
Back in the warmth of a Western-style bunkhouse built for his crew, Stevenson explains the sheer scale of what he and his two Russian partners are trying to do.
This will be the nucleus for establishing a commercial beef cow herd in this region of Russia, and hopefully to extend further than that.
Russia wants to produce 85% of its own meat by the year 2020. Right now, Russians eat less than half as much beef as the average American, and almost all of their beef comes from old dairy cows and is best used for soup. In the makeshift barn, more than 100 cows and calves shelter from the weather. Alexander Naritsin is the head veterinarian on the ranch. He says the $18 million project will help Russia's farmers meet the government's goal.
This is a very ambitious project, but it's necessary. In Russia right now, 1% of cattle are beef cattle, so our project is enormous, but it's a drop in the bucket.
Stevenson says the soil here is richer and the climate better for farming than back in Montana.
In 5 years, I wouldn't be surprised one bit to have 5,000 to 10,000 head of cattle roaming pastures within an hour's drive from this location.
That would be nothing in Stevenson's home state, but in Russia, it would be a huge step forward. In southern Russia, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
To New York City now, where a man is auctioning off his 212 area code phone number. He tells the New York Daily News, Steve, that whoever buys it will be able to avoid the humiliation of a 347 or 646 area
code. Oh, I can't do it. Perish the thought of having one of those numbers.
You don't want one of those. He warns it may make them look like they just moved to New York.
I can't believe that.
The horror. The asking price for his 212 phone number, by the way, $1 million.
Oh, that's all? What's your area code?
Actually, when I came here to L.A.
It's a long story.
I got a 213, but I gave up three 212 phone numbers that I had in my office in New York for free.
For free.
To Stacey Vanek Smith, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Yeah, I still have the 205 straight from Alabama, Jeremy.
There you go.
You know how much that's worth.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Friday, March 25th in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. AirTran and Southwest Airlines are waiting for clearance from the Justice Department after AirTran shareholders gave that merger between the two an okay earlier this week. But the big task remains, making these two very different operations into one. Now, think of Southwest as sort of a Hawaiian shirt of the airline industry, comfortable and familiar, and AirTran as the Sears suit, businesslike, affordable, no frills. From station WABE in Atlanta, Jim Burris reports on the efforts to coordinate that outfit.
Well, hello, everybody. Come in and sit down. Put your seat belt on.
On this recent flight out of Dallas, Captain Mad Dog Watson greets passengers just like he always does.
Well, hello, folks. Now that I have your attention, let me introduce myself. Captain Mad Dog Watson here.
Just another Southwest pilot? Nope. Mad Dog flies for AirTran. Bob Fornaro is that company's CEO. He says the two airlines' cultures are already a lot alike.
The key thing is I think the attitudes are similar in terms of the way we focus on the customer. And that's the most important.
Fornaro is right. Good customer service is a key goal at both airlines. But it's a poorly kept secret that at Southwest, customers actually come second. Employees come first, explains Cheryl Huey, Southwest Director of Culture Services.
We know if we're doing the right thing for our employees, that ultimately it'll be the right thing for our business, which ultimately is the right thing for our customers.
Southwest generally pays its employees better. It's not facing contentious labor disputes like AirTran. And in the most turbulent economic times, Southwest still makes money. But Southwest CEO Gary Kelly says his airline can still pick up a few pointers from AirTran.
We want to be very measured about any radical changes that we're contemplating, because what they've got works pretty darn good.
AirTran flies its planes more full, more often, and with less overhead than Southwest. All things Kelly says his airline needs to do better in order to grow.
This is a great opportunity for us to do great things for our culture, for our business, to grow Southwest Airlines, and in places that I don't think we could otherwise access.
Southwest will instantly add Caribbean destinations once it acquires AirTran, but Mexico and Canada could soon be on the horizon. In Atlanta, I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Now to a class of hedge funds that would like to make money by predicting unforeseen events like the collapse of the housing market here in the U.S. or even the earthquake in Japan. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports it's a growing business.
They're called black swan funds. Their managers look for things that are unlikely to happen, you know, like the chance of crossing paths with a black swan. Investment advisor John Sakowitz says potential payouts are huge, so they bet like a whole different animal.
They have that kind of shark-like olfactory sense.
Mick Swartz teaches finance at the University of Southern California. He says they're more risky than the usual hedge fund. Black swan funds bet on things that are outlandish.
You know, like the price of palladium might double in a year.
Or world markets might collapse. London investment firm 36 South Capital Advisors saw one of its black swans gain more than 200% during the financial crisis. Now the firm announced it will start a new fund. Chris Whalen with Institutional Risk Analytics says, save your money.
I think the whole concept is suspect.
After all, it usually takes quite a while to collect on the bets that black swan funds make, if at all. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, I don't know about you, Jeremy, but when I retire, I'm going to make a pile of jackets and coats and parkas and wool sweaters and cashmere and all these other things. I'm going to put them in one big pile and I'm going to burn them.
Yeah.
Right? Cold weather, no more. Put me on a warm, sunny beach and give me a beer and stick a fork in me. I'm done.
You live on a warm, sunny beach, Steve.
Well, but I'm not retired yet.
But I guess it's not quite as warm as maybe where
no,
you would
it's
go.
Not. Okay. It's the Pacific,
all
please.
Right.
But I may be in the minority because
yes.
Forbes magazine, Jeremy, says yes. Some colder weather climates have started popping up on the list of top places for seniors. For example.
Such as?
Pittsburgh,
uh-huh.
Indianapolis,
uh-huh.
Salt Lake City. It snows in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Gosh, there are ski resorts at Park City, all that. Fargo, North Dakota.
Really?
Fargo,
that,
North
people
Dakota.
People want to retire in Fargo.
Yes. Fargo came in at number 16 on the Forbes list. The city ranked high because of low tax rates and low crime and the availability of doctors, which I guess you would want
yeah.
as you're getting older. It's a great place to live. You betcha.
Give me your best Francis McDormand there, Steve.
You betcha.
In Los Angeles. Not planning on moving to Fargo anytime soon, although I'm sure it's great. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
What's the area code in Fargo?
I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.